and develop ethical leaders. I knew a bit about this because I'd arrived at the FBI, having spent decades watching leaders, reading about leaders, and trying to lead. From all that learning and all those mistakes, I knew the kind of leader I wanted to follow and the kind I wanted to be, and I set out immediately to try and set that example. On my first full day as FBI director, for example, I sat in an auditorium in front of a camera and spoke to all employees about my expectations for them and their expectations for me. I gave the talk sitting on a stool, wearing a tie but no jacket. I also wore a blue shirt. This may not seem like a big deal to outsiders, but Bob Mueller wore a white shirt every day for 12 years. Congress had extended his 10-year term for 2 extra years. Not some days or most days, every day. That was the culture, and I thought shirt color was one early small way to set a different tone. I said nothing about my shirt, but people noticed. I laid out my 5 expectations that first day and many times thereafter. Every new employee heard them, and I repeated them wherever I went in the organization. I expected they would find joy in their work. They were part of an organization devoted to doing good, protecting the weak, rescuing the taken, and catching criminals. That was work with moral content. Doing it should be a source of great joy. I expected they would treat all people with respect and dignity, without regard to position or station in life. I expected they would protect the institution's reservoir of trust and credibility that makes possible all their work. I expected they would work hard because they owe that to the taxpayer. And I expected they would fight for balance in their lives. I emphasize that last one because I worried many people in the FBI worked too hard, driven by the mission, and absorbed too much stress from what they saw. I talked about what I had learned from a year of watching Dick Cates in Madison, Wisconsin. I expected them to fight to keep a life, to fight for the balance of other interests, other activities, other people, outside of work. I explained that judgment was essential to the sound exercise of power. Because they would have great power to do good, or if they abused that power, to do harm, I needed sound judgment, which is the ability to orbit a problem and see it well, including through the eyes of people very different from you. I told them that although I wasn't sure where it came from, I knew the ability to exercise judgment was protected by getting away from the work and refreshing yourself. That physical distance made perspective possible when they returned to work. And then I got personal. There are people in your lives called loved ones because you are supposed to love them. In our work, I warned, there is a disease called get-back-itis. That is, you may tell yourself, I'm trying to protect a country, so I will get back to my spouse, my kids, my parents, my siblings, my friends. There is no getting back, I said. In this line of work, you will learn that bad things happen to good people. You will turn to get back, and they will be gone. I order you to love somebody. It's the right thing to do, and it's also good for you. I added something I learned from Stellar Wind and the torture struggle. When someone is tired, their judgment can be impaired. And when they are dragging, it's hard for them to float above a problem and picture themselves and the problem in another place in time. So I gave them another directive, sleep. When you sleep, your brain is actually engaged in the neurochemical process of judgment. It is mapping connections and finding meaning among all the data you took in during the day. Tired people tend not to have the best judgment. And it is not as hard as you may think, I added with a smile. You can multitask. You can sleep with people you love in appropriate circumstances. One day during my first week, around noon, I walked out of my huge office through my huge conference room and past the desk of Bob Mueller's administrative assistant, who would work with me for another few months. She had been there for decades and was an invaluable resource to me, but was much more familiar with a different style of leadership. Where are you going? She asked. To get a sandwich, I said. Why are you doing that? Because I'm hungry. I'm just going to run up to the cafeteria. What if people try to talk to you? She asked with a bewildered look. I hope they talk to me. Whenever I possibly could during my 3 years, 8 months, and 5 days as FBI director, I would walk down a long hall and up a flight of stairs to the FBI headquarters cafeteria. I never wore my jacket. I asked my security detail to stay far enough away from me that people would think I was walking alone. I didn't want FBI employees to think I needed to be protected from them. No matter how I felt inside, I tried to walk with a bounce in my step, standing straight and smiling at those I passed. The way I looked at it, when the director of the FBI stepped into that cafeteria, hundreds of pairs of eyes turned to look, and every pair was asking, in some form, the same question. So how are we doing? The answer from my face and posture had to be, we're doing just fine. It's all going to be okay. I also never cut the line. Even when I wished I could, or even when I was in a hurry, I stood and waited as people in front of me ordered panini, which take forever, by the way. I thought it was very important to show people that I'm not better than anyone else, so I waited. The wait in line also allowed me to interview people. I would turn to the person next to me and ask them to tell me their story, including what they liked about their job at the FBI. I learned a tremendous amount from these many conversations. One lesson was that I wasn't the big deal I thought I was. One day after I'd been on the job for close to a year, I turned to the guy behind me and asked him about himself. I learned that he worked on computer servers. He said he'd been with the FBI for 3 years, and what he liked best about the agency was that he could get experience and responsibility far beyond what the private sector offered someone his age. There was an awkward pause, and he probably thought he needed to be polite. So he asked, "How about yourself?" "I'm the director," I replied. Bobbing his head side to side to emphasize his question, he asked, "Director of..." "Dude," I said, "I'm the director of the FBI. You work for me." Another awkward pause. Finally, he said, "Oh, you look so different online." That evening, I went home and told Patrice that story. "That should happen to you every day," she said with a laugh. Before I became FBI director, I worked at Bridgewater Associates, which aspires to build a culture of complete transparency and honesty. I learned there that I could sometimes be a selfish and poor leader. Most often that was because I was hesitant to tell people who work for me when I thought they needed to improve. The best leaders are both kind and tough. Without both, people don't thrive. Bridgewater's founder, Ray Dalio, believes there is no such thing as negative feedback or positive feedback. There is only accurate feedback, and we should care enough about each other to be accurate. By avoiding hard conversations and not telling people where they were struggling and how they could improve, I was depriving them of the chance to grow. My squeamishness was not only cowardly, it was selfish. If I really care about the people who work for me, if I create the atmosphere of deep personal consideration I want,